to 2, paragraph 5. Now, we're talking about reward and punishment. We're talking about the fact that every transgression has to be, it leaves a residue that has to be removed before entry into Olam Haba, because in Olam Haba, in the world to come, there is no evil. Paragraph 5, he deepens this concept. I'll put it in our terms, but I'm explaining his concept. How are mitzvos and rewards related? Of course, you are rewarded for the mitzvos that you do. But how is the particular reward related to the particular mitzvah that you do? For example, in this world, when you work at a job, you get paid in money. You could be a plumber, or an accountant, or a bus driver, or computer programmer. At the end of the day, you all get money. If you look at the money, you really wouldn't have a clue as to what the person did to get the money, except that if he got the most money, he was the plumber. What you get is not related in any specific way to what you did in order to earn it. Now, the reward in Olam Haba is not like that at all. Rather, each action has an effect, and the reward is tailor-suited to that action, so that, in the end, the person will be able to see the total of his reward, detail by detail, and be able to trace each detail in the reward to something that he did. This is part of the idea of seeing God's justice. This means seeing it in detail. Seeing God's justice on the one hand, I can see that what he gave me follows exactly what I did. And on the other hand, knowing that I got it because of what I did. I got it because of my own efforts. It wasn't given to me for nothing. On the contrary, I earned it by doing those actions. How is this correspondence made? How is it that the reward is detail for detail related to the actions that I perform? It's because the action that a person performs creates in him a certain capacity, and that capacity becomes later the medium for the reward. So, it works like this. Bach is a better composer. Bach's music is better than that of the Beatles. Period. This is not a matter of opinion. It's not a matter of feeling. It's not a matter of each person's own perception and pleasure. This is a matter of fact. Bach's music is better than that of the Beatles. I know. You don't believe me. That's because you're Jewish. Let me explain to you why this is so. What I'm telling you now is really a point made by John Stuart Mill. Everyone who is competent to understand and appreciate both Bach and the Beatles prefers Bach. Everyone who is competent to understand and appreciate both Bach and the Beatles prefers Bach. So, I mean, that's the experience of all people who have ever listened to music. So if I find a person who says he prefers the Beatles to Bach, it's overwhelmingly likely that he just doesn't appreciate Bach. He doesn't know how to listen to Bach. He can't hear it. In Bach, sometimes you have three voices. One voice introduces a theme, and then goes off on a variation, and the second voice introduces the same theme, and goes off in a variation. The third voice introduces the theme a third time, and then the theme comes back in one voice and back in another voice, and the variations are related to the theme. To appreciate that piece, you've got to be able to hear all three themes, have them running separately in your mind, picture them, and see how they interact, and follow it all the way to the end. If you can't do that, you're not hearing the music. If you're not hearing the music, then it's not surprising you'll find it boring, because you're missing it. You're not getting it. Everyone who's capable of appreciating Bach and the Beatles prefers Bach. That's a reason to say that Bach is really better music than the Beatles. And a person who doesn't see it that way is just because he hasn't learned to appreciate Bach. This is said in the same spirit in which, the example I made to you last night, most of you weren't there for last night's show, you'll have a person who's brought up in Dubai. All he's ever seen is sand. And now he gets a video of people skiing in the Alps. And he says, this must be what they do to people in prison. They put them on wooden boards, and they put them on a cold, wet mountain, and they force them to risk their life. There must be soldiers behind with guns, you know, forcing them to do this, because no one would do this of his own free will. This is crazy. And somebody says, pay closer attention to the expressions on the faces of the people in the video. Do they look like they're suffering, or do they look like they're having a good time? It's part of the punishment to pretend that you're having a good time. They couldn't have possibly had a good time doing that. Now, what do we say to this poor fellow who's living on the sand in Dubai? He's never been to the Alps, friend. See, if you've been there and tried it, you'll find out that they're having a great time. You just haven't been there. I think this is objectively true. Skiing is fun is objectively true. Because almost everyone who does it has fun doing it. If everyone prefers Bach to the Beatles, everyone who's capable of appreciating both, then Bach's music is better than that of the Beatles. And it makes a difference, because once you know that, you know that you're missing something, and you know that if you invest in training yourself to understand it, you'll benefit, because you'll have something that's better. Something which you'll know is better when you're trained to do it. Just like everybody else is trained to do it, we'll take Bach over the Beatles every time. And then you have a reason for doing it, just like the kid in Dubai has a reason to go to the Alps. I mean, the guy in Dubai, you know, has an annual allowance of $10 million, right? And so he can easily make it to the Alps. And he knows it's worth it because other people are enjoying it. So here too, once you know that everybody who's listened to both Bach and the Beatles and appreciates both prefers Bach, you know that if you don't like Bach, you're missing out on something very precious, something much better than the Beatles. Now, let's imagine that, I mean, this will sound like really a horrible possibility, but let's imagine that Olam Haba is listening to Bach. Well, if you don't invest in learning how to hear it, you're not going to get very much out of Olam Haba. You're going to listen to Bach forever and not hear it, not get it, not appreciate it. You know, it just sounds like random notes. Well, that's pretty terrible, I think. And if you learn how to appreciate two or three part inventions, which is what I was talking about before, but you don't learn how to appreciate circular fugues and stuff. So then, whatever you learn to appreciate, that's what you'll be able to appreciate and enjoy. It means each effort that I make in improving myself creates a capacity, and that capacity is what I use to be able to enjoy Olam Haba. And that way, I see that everything I get there is dependent specifically upon what I did, and for everything that I did, the reward is open and manifest, and it comes from there. That's point number one. Yeah.
You mentioned taking example of people from
Bach. Oh, you're British. You don't care. You can't be fair about this. Yeah, go ahead.
But you said that there could possibly be nobody who does have an appreciation of both and will like Beatles better.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah. It would be like saying that there's nobody who could appreciate skiing on a 100-foot mountain and hill and skiing on a 1,000-foot mountain and who prefers the 100-foot hill to the 1,000-foot mountain. I think that's right. Anybody who can handle himself on skis is not going to spend time on a 100-foot hill. Yeah. Right? It's a waste of time. It's boring. It's no challenge. On both of them. Correct. That's right. Anybody who's competent to appreciate both is not going to, you know, one of the things about a thing like the Beatles, I like the Beatles, you know, they're cute and, you know, But it's monumentally boring. When you appreciate a composer like Bach, like Beethoven, where every 10 seconds there's a new idea, and it's related to the old idea, and it develops into a whole, that you find the other just monumentally boring. Why does it go over and over all the time? Didn't you have any new ideas recently? You know, it's just colossally boring.
You only need one person to say that they like that really understands Bach and says they like the Beatles better than Bach to disrupt your theory.
Maybe, but interestingly, I don't think there are any. Just as I don't think you'll find anybody, not even one person who can handle himself on a 1,000-foot mountain on skis, who prefers skiing on a 100-foot hill. Can you imagine such a thing? I can't imagine.
I mean, everybody's different.
No, as a matter of fact, everybody's not different, otherwise there couldn't be a science of medicine.
Well,
they're different in some respects and not different in other respects.
There are some medications that would work. Less of it would work better on people, and more of it would work better on people. You know, people are different
in some ways. In some ways, but not in all ways. And in this, I think it would be very hard to imagine a person who can handle himself on a 1,000-foot mountain.
Yeah, but music, things like this are that's the way that people are different.
So I challenge you. I challenge you. In all of my musical experience, I was a musician for a long time. And I met some people. And in university, I spoke to people who liked all different kinds of music. But never did anybody ever mention hearing of a person who could understand Bach. And prefer. You know, imagine you're going to be shipwrecked on an island for a year. And you can take along 5 CDs. And you have to choose between Bach and the Beatles. How many Beatles would you take? The answer is 0.
Because the fact is, there are times when you prefer listening to the Beatles to Bach. Impact on that argument at all?
No, because there are times when you're so exhausted. You know, a person who just recovered from a broken leg and who is now finds it difficult to imagine, is afraid of the 1,000-foot mountain, that he might prefer the 100-foot hill. But he's not a person who, at the time, is competent to handle both. Now, Bach requires a certain amount of involvement and work and attention. Person may say, you know, I'm doing something else. All I want is background music. I don't want to be distracted. I don't want to pay attention to music. I want the music just to be background. So then he might put on the Beatles. That's because he's not into the music. But the person into the music, he wants the musical experience. He's just not going to go for it. Yeah.
I think that Bach and Beatles are not comparable at all. As to me, it's like you always say, it's oranges and apples, because they have different purposes, and music is not doesn't go like according to the complexity. I mean, it's, if we'll start to compare it by its difficulty, but let's say to compare it, Bach is more complicated music by the way how it's arranged. The way how it sounds and how it's written is more complicated, but it's not math.
But it's not what?
Mathematics. But in the case of mathematics, that comparison would be correct. But in the case of the music, it's more of feelings, not more of comparison what is more complicated.
Of course, but I didn't say people will do math when they listen to Bach. I said that in listening to Bach, they'll prefer to listen to Bach than they will to listen to the Beatles. But the listening experience.
Depends on the mood, I think. No, today I want to listen to this. Tomorrow I can appreciate both. It's not a matter of what I hear.
I doubt it very much, but even if so, I give you the example of a person who's going to be marooned for a year, and he's got to choose which CDs to take along with him. And he can take any mixture of Bach and Beatles that he wants, but he only gets 5. I guarantee you, they'll take all 5 Bach. They won't take it. They're always going to be, you know, a person's drunk. So he says, well, I'm drunk, I can't follow. But then he can't follow it. If he can't follow it, then he's not really competent at that moment to appreciate both. A person who's competent to appreciate both, paying attention to the experience, is not going to spend time going to the view. How many people who can appreciate Bach will pay money to go to a Beatles concert? I mean, next to none. It's a first waste of money. Yeah.
Well, I think this is a more complicated concept, the idea of the perfect or the ideal observer, which is presented in philosophy. It's not something which is just, you know, accepted. I mean, it's been argued as a really good problematic thing in philosophy, like very problematic.
I'm not talking about the ideal observer. I'm not making that argument. The ideal observer is creating a construct that doesn't exist in the real world and using him as a standard for making judgments that are supposed to be defendable judgments. I'm talking, I mean, this is Mill's point. Mill's point is about real people in the real world who are definitely not ideal observers. They're just, you know, people like you and me, but with a level of competence. Right? You're not going to ask a blind person for his opinion of Picasso and Rembrandt. And you're not going to ask a person who can't hear a three-part invention for his opinion of Bach because he's not hearing the music.
I mean, even this idea, though, even Mill's idea, is there's no controversy about it, and it's just accepted. I mean,
well, you know, there could be controversy, but Mill is right. I don't think we have to be. You know, even the New York Times, as Philistine as they are, and as pop multicultural as they are, and as pop relativist as they are, published this a few years ago as an argument that, you know, not all performances are equal and not all composers are equal. You know, what would a music critic do? If there's no way to give objective evaluation of performances, what is he doing? He's just telling you what he likes. But he's listened. He's listened to thousands of performances. So he can pick out the nuances. Let's take Gourmet Chef. Now, most of us cannot taste the fine spices that the chef puts in the food. We can test this. Have one dish with it, one dish without it, and ask whether we can tell the difference, right? Now comes along a person who can taste all the fine. So he's getting out of the experience something that I'm not getting. That's objectively testable. If it's objectively testable that he's getting more of the experience, then his judgment is more reliable than mine. Right? Because his judgment applies to more of the real experience that's there than mine, because I'm missing it. Like a colorblind person passing judgment on art. He's not qualified because he only sees his gray. He doesn't see the colors. This is a standard we apply in all of life. The person who has more experience and more understanding, his judgment is more reliable. Once you recognize that in aesthetics, there are people with more understanding and more experience, and that the judgments are stable. They're stable. When you get more and more experience and more understanding, the judgments coalesce. They don't disagree. Now, when they do disagree, if you'll ask who's better, Bach or Beethoven, then you have disagreement. Actually, probably not. Probably most people will say they're very great. You can't tell, if at all, who's better. But, you know, if you'll have a case where they do disagree, then the criterion doesn't apply. The argument is not the criterion always applies. The argument is when it applies, it's correct. Yeah.
I'll play piano for 12 years. I would say I prefer playing Bach to learn a sonata to learn something like Yesterday.
Well, I can certainly appreciate that. But you would never listen to Bach?
I played Bach, played conventions and stuff like that, but I just find it very hard. I find it almost
too
challenging.
Oh, okay. So first, as I say, when you're in a mood, or when you're tired, or when you're drunk, or whatever it is, and you can't work yourself up to... So then that's a condition in which you're not really capable of appreciating both. Mill's point only is when you're capable of appreciating both, and you have a choice between the two, the one you're going to choose is Bach, for sure. Right? Just like no one's going to choose the 100-foot hill over the 1,000-foot hill. People don't vary in that way. Yeah.
So what you would say to a person that says that they do understand Bach to the fullest extent and they enjoy listening to the Beatles, you'll say they don't?
I would test them. It's very easy to test. I can sit him down and ask him, when does the second theme start? When does the first voice play the inversion of the theme? Right, and see if he can figure it out. My guess is that he won't be able to do it. He thinks he understands it because he doesn't know what there is there to understand. If you'll ever listen to the 5th Brandenburg Concerto, the first movement, he knows what I'm talking about. At the end of the first movement, there's a long harpsichord solo. And it goes on and on and on. I once, when I was in high school, took three of my friends, three close friends, and I forced them to sit down and listen to this. Right? And as I'm listening and climbing the walls with excitement, they're sitting there twiddling their thumbs, looking at their watches, waiting for the thing to be over. You know? And then I realized that if you can't hear it, it just sounds like meaningless exercises. You know? Because you don't see where it's going. You don't see what it's building to. You don't see... I must tell you, I when I was in high school and I had to take literature courses, I really hated it. I mean, it was, to me, I had no sensitivity to it whatsoever. But I think it's in Wuthering Heights, maybe. There's a description, there's a scene where somebody's in a chair, in an armchair, and he's sitting there motionless with his eyes closed. And the author describes the light coming in and the gentle breeze, and he says there's a fly buzzing around. The fly lands on his hand. He must be very distracted. He doesn't even notice the fly in his hand. And then a couple of pages go by, he goes going on and on. And then the fly takes off from his hand and lands on his nose. I was very distracted. And then, I'm not getting all the details right, but then he goes on and says, and notice the pallor in his face. He looks quite pale. And anyway, after 10 pages, you realize the guy's dead. But it takes 10 pages to realize he's dead. Now, that really captivated me. Reading. I'm being taken in by the story, you know, and following the author. That all of a sudden, you sort of begin to feel something's wrong, and then it hits you, and then he says, the guy's dead. That was really an exercise. Right? Now, imagine a person who's, you know, reading it like he reads the newspaper, you know. So what happened already? Another page? Forget it. No, I'm not going to do this. I'll read the trial. Someone will tell me the end of the story. Okay, then he's not getting it. He's just not getting it. He's not experiencing it. He's not entering into it. If he would, then it would be hard for him to go back to comic books. Yeah?
I saw an article in the Wall Street Journal about the guy who smells fish, sees it decomposed, and there's different levels, different degrees of smelling. And people can't argue with him because his word in court is the best of professional opinion about smelling.
Yeah. But
he's trained in it, so that's right. People who argue in practical sense, that's what they do. Yeah. So this guy says that's what it is. You can say, well, for me it smells fine, it doesn't count.
Because you can take pieces of fish, which he doesn't see, and look at them objectively and test them. This one's 5 days old, this one's 4 days old, this one's 3 days old, 2 days old. And you can give them to him and ask him to put them in order of age, and he can do it. So you can test this objectively. Like wine tasters. Right? You can test them objectively. Take 10 bottles, take off the labels, and they'll tell you every time exactly what it is. So this is not just a matter of arbitrarily testing someone's taste. This is a question of having an objective test. This person is smelling things that the rest of us aren't sensitive to. And you can do it with taste, and you can do it with sound as well. As I said, it's very, very easy to do, yeah.
Are you suggesting we should always ascribe to this methodology when we determine what's good or not?
Well, when it applies, it's correct. Very often it doesn't apply. When you ask people what they prefer, A or B, you'll have differences of opinion. When the difference of opinion, Mill's criterion gives you nothing. But when it applies, I think we should, at the very least this, as I said before, let's think of the practical application of it. If everybody's experience, A and B, prefers A, and I have my choice what to invest in, I should go for A. I shouldn't think that I'm going to be different from everybody who's tested both of them. Why should I think that? Just like the kid in Dubai, looking at the video and realizing that these people are all having fun, says, well, then if I go to the Alps, I'll probably have fun also. Why? Because they're human and I'm human. We have the same reflexes. We have roughly the same pleasure and pain reactions. So why should I think that I won't enjoy it as well? So if everybody who's capable of understanding both Bach and the Beatles prefers Bach, then I know that if I don't prefer Bach, I'm missing something. Look, I'm a classical musician. I was for many years. I appreciated all the classical music except Mozart. I never got into Mozart. Mozart, to me, was just boring. Now, my great friend, Chaim Salinger, who's a big Mozart fan, kept telling me year after year, I got to listen to Mozart. It's important to listen to Mozart. About 6 years ago, I took him seriously, and I started to listen to him, and I finally got it. It took me all those decades. I don't know what snapped. And now Mozart music is just as beloved to me as the music of all the other composers. But I was missing it. Now, for me to say, well, you know, Mozart's not any better than trash because I don't like it, is ridiculous. If all those people love it, and they're all as intelligent as I am or more so, and they know as much music as I do or more so, and they can appreciate all the things I can, then I must be missing something. I think that's an objective criterion. Least objective in terms of the capacity of human beings to appreciate and what they will gain from if they invest in trying to be able to appreciate. That much we get, at least. Yeah.
Just try that with the Beatles.
But I have. I can follow the themes in the Beatles. I can tell you where it repeats over and over and over and over again. You know?
Is that all there is to music? Mathematical complexity and
know, like, there are other aspects to music besides that. You can't just treat it as an academic exercise.
That's quite true, but the things that cause the feelings in music are pretty much identifiable. After all, there are better and worse popular songs also. There are popular writers who just don't make it, and then there are popular writers who make it big, right? So if I could tell you which ones are better and which ones are worse, and I could point out what makes this better, and I can show you where the climax is, and where the lead-up is, and where the anticlimax is, then it seems to me I can qualify as getting what there is to get. If I'm getting what there is to get, and I find it only mildly interesting, and somebody else finds it ecstatic, then I say to him, that's because of the poverty of your experience. If your experience had included what I've seen, you wouldn't say that anymore. We say that in everything, right? A person who lives in California, and he talks about the magnificent valleys. You say to him, have you been to the Grand Canyon? No? Okay. So don't tell me about your magnificent valleys. When you see the Grand Canyon, you'll see a valley. Until then, you know, you're a 2,000-foot valley. You know, give me a break. You know, that's objective. The guy has limited experience, so his judgment doesn't count as much. That's true in all of life.
There are these bands that they have like a cult following. And they're steadfast on their belief that this band is the most amazing band. There'll be even, say, 5,000 across the, you know, America that loves this band, right? And they love it their whole lives. And what do you say about that?
I say that they don't fit Mill's criterion, because there'll be other people who understand the music just as well that prefer another band. Listen again. The point is, whenever the criterion applies, it's true. Not that it always applies. I'm saying this the third time now. I'm not saying it always applies. When there's split opinion of equally competent people, then the criterion doesn't apply, and I have no way to say which is better, according to this criterion. This criterion only applies when everybody agrees as to which is better. But I think you'll have that in bands also. I think you'll have that in bands also. If they don't have strobe lights, no one will like them. That's the first criterion. They have to have strobe lights, and they have to jump around on the stage, and they have to make fools of themselves. Without that, the music's not worth it. But with all of that, you have bands that are more successful and bands that are less successful. The Beatles were famous as a band. The music was something that they used and they chose, but they were famous as a band. Right? So, and then you'll have other bands which, you know, people go to only if they have nothing better to do. But they're not going to, not everybody becomes a millionaire by playing music in popular bands. Yeah.
Does your argument ultimately still rest on a scientific sort of approach to music?
No, it's a question of preference. Who likes better? That's all. But you have to have competence.
That's what I mean. But your competence is sort of, it sounds like it's scientific competence, like understanding the whatever it is. I don't understand any of it, but I cry when I hear Bach. Then I sort of kind of, but Beatles are fun. But I, you know, when I hear Bach, I say, there has got to be a God. I hear the Beatles, I say, this is great, but I don't remember ever thinking, there has to be a God. Now,
well, I think it is possible for a person to respond intuitively without ever formally mastering. My appreciation for classical music comes because my parents, the Lamer Sholem, used to play classical music on phonograph records, which you probably read about in history books, outside my bedroom when I was a little child, and I used to fall asleep to classical music. You know, so I could sing it from beginning to end, and I didn't know there was a sonata allegro form with a first theme, and then bridge music, and a second theme, and then a closing, and then development, and then a recapitulation where the second theme is not fifth above, but it's in the same key as the first theme. I didn't learn that till I was in college, but I could sing whole symphonies, you know, from beginning to end, and I just learned to love it. That is true, but I think there also a person can appreciate if he has this natural gift, like they're natural pianists, you know, they sit down at the piano and they play, and they play without instruction and without training. In America, in the 19th century, there was a blind black child who learned to play the piano by sitting down and running his fingers over the keys. And he became a very fine pianist. Well, I don't think anybody can explain how that happened. But so there are people who have a natural bent and a natural appreciation. But I wouldn't use them for Mill's criteria. For Mill's criteria, you have to have some way of seeing that the person appreciates what is. And you take a person who's a for whom English is a second language. I would not use him in Mill's criterion for Shakespeare. You have to have a very fine ear for English in reading Shakespeare. Probably, if English is a second language, he's going to miss a lot of what Shakespeare is doing. Quite right. So he doesn't have the competence that's relevant. You want to call it scientific? I'm not going to fight with the adjective, but I don't think it means anything for the argument. Yeah.
Isn't one problem that sort of define what we mean by competence, competent observer. And I mean, maybe there's some times where, you know, which seems fine, like everyone agrees with it. I mean, maybe the example with Bach and Beatles is something more common. But if you take, like, the example with food, maybe, and then maybe that's a better example. But there comes times when there's disagreement, when the qualifications for being competent is sort of gets muddled.
I don't see that it's going to apply here. I mean, Bach wrote canons into his music. A canon is an identifiable form. A person who can't hear the canon doesn't know what he was doing.
But generally, though, that they're not necessarily just about this, just generally. Is that a problem, though, with applying the competence?
Maybe. I think you have to define it from context to context. And, you know, I don't know. I remember there was a skier, a French skier named Jean-Claude Key. I probably pronounced Key in French. And they said he has the worst skiing form that anybody ever saw. He just wins the races, that's all. I think he got a gold medal in the Olympics. With the worst form, not so. What makes a bad form if he's winning the races? You know, doesn't work for most people or something. At that point, I'm worried. I'm worried about competence, I'm worried about objectivity, I'm worried about appreciation. And there you'll find disagreement. Precisely there you'll find disagreements among the people, who all of whom could be regarded as competent because of this familiarity with the subject and their expertise in the subject.
So, I mean, how much disagreement does it take for us to just disabandon this methodology?
No, you don't abandon the methodology. You apply it where it applies. Where it applies, it gives you the results that it predicts. And where it doesn't apply, it doesn't apply. You don't have to give up the methodology. When there's disagreement, the criterion doesn't apply. It only applies when everybody agrees. So maybe that's one case out of 100. So for one case out of 100, you have a criterion that gives you a definite result. Use it where it works, and don't use it where it doesn't work, which would be the Council of Wisdom. All right, now, I meant this only as an example to show you that your preparation... No, I wanted you to learn this also. I wanted you to learn this also. But in the context of this book, it means that the reward that you get is something that you created in yourself the capacity to appreciate. Now, appreciation leads to the following consequence. Six I already talked about before, so we can recap. So before, we're on to seven. Those people who are qualified for the world to come, and if they have transgressions on the record, so the residue has to be wiped out. We talked yesterday about how to wipe it out. Still, they're not going to be all on the same level in the world to come. Because each appreciation that you have in the world to come as a result of the actions that you performed here. So, those who perform more and better are going to have more appreciation. Those who perform less or more poorly are going to have less. So the world to come has no evil in it, but it has different levels of good, different levels of enjoyment, different levels of appreciation. But no evil. Now, I must tell you, about a year ago, I thought of an objection to this, and I've asked a number of people, and I don't know an answer, but I'll just mention it to you. There's a statement in the Talmud which says that in Olam Habo, is it Olam Olam Habo, or a stage in Olam Habo? Sounds like it's the whole thing. Maybe someone could stick at that. Each person will be burned by the chuppah, the canopy, prepared for his friend. So the commentators say that when you look around at Olam Habo and you see how other people are doing, in some cases you'll say, he got that? I could have done that. If he got that, I could have done better than that. And each person will have a pang of regret that he didn't do more. Now, the problem is, a pang of regret is a pain in both senses. And how come pain is there in Olam Habo? What's pain doing there? Pain is something which is evil. It hides God's purpose of doing chesed, doing loving kindness. So, how is that compatible with his statement that in the world to come there is no evil? I don't know an answer. As I told you, I asked people, just mentioning it as a problem. And if you'll find somebody, you can ask. It'll give you an answer. Pass it back on to me. I would love to hear. Now, a more complicated case. I'll tell you what he says, and I'll tell you how I understand it. We're coming back to what I told you yesterday, what I sent to you yesterday in class. Let's imagine a person who's very productive. This guy's very productive. He does lots and lots and lots and lots. He sleeps only 2 hours a night, you know. He does lots and lots of good things and lots of bad things. So, according to what we said so far, the bad things leave the residue prevents him from appreciating all the mavor, that has to be wiped out. So it's wiped out. Suffering in this world, suffering in the next world, the combination, it's wiped out. Okay. Now that the suffering was wiped out, the residue of the bad, and the bad is gone, all that's left is the good. Now his good record is really very impressive. Because remember, this guy only slept 2 hours a night. Right? So he had 11 hours a day of powerful, good performance. So he's going to be way up there. Way up there with the Tipitaka. Says Ramchal, he doesn't belong way up there. He doesn't belong up there. Because if you evaluate him on the basis of his total performance, he's mediocre. He's only 50-50. Now, Ramchal seems to say the quality of his total performance really is what ought to determine his place in the world to come. The fact that he was hyperactive his whole life and never got around to taking Ritalin, that shouldn't be something he gets rewarded for just because he's hyperactive. If his total picture is mediocre, so then he deserves a mediocre place in Olam HaBa. The trouble is, the principles we've used so far, you got it ready? No? Then think ahead. Right? The principle you use so far is you're going to wipe out the evil and reward him for the good in Olam HaBa. He's going to be in a place where he doesn't deserve to be. So therefore we can reward him for some of the good here. Right? We can reward him for some of the good here so as to reduce his record of good, so that when he gets to Olam HaBa and he receives reward for all the remaining good, he'll be at a position in Olam HaBa that's appropriate for the totality of his performance. So here's the second person who's going to be rewarded here rather than there. Even though, as I told you yesterday, the Talmud says there's no reward in this world. And the answer I told you was that we'll value it for him at his own valuation. But still, we're paying him off here for something that he did, some good action that he did, which, according to the Talmud statement, it's got to be an exception to the Talmud statement. And the only explanation is the one I told you yesterday.
You asked yesterday how a person could get paid off here, and you said maybe we're going to give an answer because to take what it's worth for him.
Right.
If you care, how are you going to make a take off any of the good that he did for him? We're not even using that.
Well, I think you can, because remember, this guy's 50-50. It's 50 good and 50 bad. Well, the 50 bad will include missing mitzvahs from time to time, right? On the basis of something else he can get for it. I mean, he's got 11 hours a day of transgressions, right? Remember, he's super productive. 11 hours a day of good, now 11 hours a day of bad. The 11 hours a day of bad probably give you enough examples by which you can tell what the value of the mitzvah was to him, and you can pay him off in those terms. But that's the second case of where a person might be paid off in this world. Yeah.
Did you say that we were judged in relation to our total production over
yes.
our life?
Yes.
So then should one be wary not to do things that are not productive, that are not mitzvah?
Oh yes, and in fact I mentioned this a couple of times. Let's go back. Remember when I talked about the people for whom there are 613 problems? Yes? That's the same point. A mitzvah is an opportunity to connect. To invest in an activity that's not mitzvah means that you're investing in blank time. Time that doesn't connect. That's extravagantly dumb. Right? Now, you can connect with tennis also. Right? We talked about rest and recreation. We talked about satisfying psychological needs. You can connect, but it's got to be done in such a way that there's a connect. If there's no connect, then you're wasting the resources that you have. And those resources are the only opportunity that you have to make something productive out of your life. Right?
Yes. So just visiting a sun center,
I'm sorry.
This sounds like there's a cap on how much reward you can get in the next world based on how many transgressions you have.
Um, Well, in a way, that's right, because that will color the quality of your total performance. And it's the quality of your total performance that determines the place that you get.
I just want to make sure
it's that not just the number of individual actions, it's the quality of the total performance. That's what the Ramchal is saying.
Is there some negativity to, I don't know, to climbing the Alps just because it's such a high?
Yeah. Yeah. Why did you climb it? Because it was there.
No, because
That's probably a good reason for a fox, you know, or for an eagle. But for a thinking, feeling human being.
I didn't say climb it because it's there. I said climb it because it's just so neat. It just feels so good to do.
Well, I think that's the feeling that the bear has when he wades into the stream, you know, and rolls back and forth in the water. It just so feels so good to do. Look at it this way. Think of the rest of your humanity that you're leaving out. Think of the rest of your humanity that you're leaving out. What you're doing is turning off the higher parts of your humanity and just investing in the lower parts of your psychology.
Let me just, maybe ask it back.
Let me ask you a question. I'm training to be a surgeon, okay? Or I'm a surgeon and I'm practicing my technique. Now, I can practice on a plastic dummy, or I can plastic on a person who's dying and who needs my surgery to stay alive. In both cases, I have the microsurgery and I have the microscopes and I have all the coordination stuff and so on. But in one case, I'm saving a life. In the other case, I'm not. So now, seems to me that if I can engage my morality and my spirituality and my humanity in saving a life, why would I do it on a plastic dummy?
I can't answer the question. Could I raise mine in a way that would be more, since we're talking about music, is there something negative about listening to Bach for the sheer pleasure?
But now you've changed the question. Before you asked, you didn't ask, is it something negative? You asked, is it really lacking anything positive? Those are two entirely different questions. The question of whether it's negative is a question really, is it a transgression? Yeah, if it's Shabbos and you turn on the stereo, that you're not supposed to do, that's definitely negative. But as he put it, and somebody else put it, think of the waste of the opportunity to do something positive. There's something called opportunity cost in business, right?
So
opportunities are very valuable.
Well, okay, you're saying that any time that you don't use your opportunity to do a, whatever, mitzvah, you're losing an opportunity to do a mitzvah.
Quite right. When you have in mind, as I said a moment ago, that playing tennis could be a mitzvah also. Don't think of a mitzvah only as some formal religious act. Playing tennis can also be a mitzvah.
How?
Okay, I gave a whole shiur about this the other night. I spoke about this at length, and it was recorded by these three little friends here. Maybe two out of three, and another one. The idea is that, the rough idea is this. Any means to a mitzvah is also a mitzvah. So, if I'm so tense that I'm going to explode, and because I'm so tense, I can't deal with people in a sensitive fashion, in a kind of friendly fashion. I can't put myself out to serve other people's needs. And doubles tennis for 2 hours relaxes me and lowers my hypertension, so I'm in better physical shape, and then I can deal with people the way they should be dealt with. Then the tennis can be a means to performing mitzvos, and the tennis played in that spirit. I'm here because I want to serve God, and I'm so tense I can't serve God, and I'm doing this in order to be able to serve Him better. In that case, the tennis also becomes a mitzvah. And the tennis becomes a means of connecting with God. Same with eating, same with sleeping, same with all what to call the physical needs. And now, if you want an appreciation of God's grandeur, like Rosh Hashanah Fuller Hirsch said, a Jew had the opportunity to see the Alps and didn't go to see the Alps, he's going to give an accounting for it in the world to come. God will say, you didn't see my Alps? Yeah. But not because they're neat. Not because they're there. Not because they're so high. And this summer I went hiking in the Alps, so I don't know what I'm talking about. Right? But because God created this world, and He created in me the ability to appreciate grandeur, and I get a feeling for God's grandeur when I go there. Yes, I can appreciate, I can increase my awareness of God, my connection of God, my connection to God, my appreciation of God. Then it becomes a mitzvah. Yeah.
I'm trying to understand. You said that If your transgressions match the good deeds that you do, your good deeds can't go any higher than your transgressions.
No,
they have to be.
That's not what I said. What I said was this: a person's place in the world to come should be determined by the quality of his overall performance. Let's take two people. One person who is created with very limited capacities, very limited energy, and he's just not very productive. And what he does is, let's say, 80-20. 80 good and 20 bad. He's making an effort. He's making considerable with what he does to do very good things. Just that he hasn't got much strength, and he hasn't got much intelligence, and he hasn't got much focus. So, but what he does is, now I got another person with who's given terrific energy and terrific focus and terrific drive and a fine, sharp, focused mind, and he turns out 80-20. So now, should they really be judged differently? They're both 80-20. What would make them different? That this one started with more energy, more focus, more drive, and a better mind? Those are gifts from God. They shouldn't make a difference to what he gets for what he created. It's the 80-20 that counts. Right, that's roughly the idea. Yeah.
The concept, going back to hyper productivity, what you were talking about,
yeah.
That person, when do we start saying that someone is hyper productivity? Where's the boundary between productivity and hyper productivity?
I don't think it's a boundary, it's a matter of degree. It's a continuum.
The more hyper productive you are, the more your good is going to be rewarded in this life.
Compared to someone else who has the same balance, that's right. Only compared to someone else who has the same balance.
So like an equation,
you can figure out like how much. Well, okay. But that's the idea. Just producing more doesn't necessarily make you better. Increasing your percentage will make you better. Yeah, make your position better. That's the idea, yeah.
If you mentioned about things being given gifts by God, like your ability, abilities, and if you yourself develop a productive state, however, a consequence of that is you produce more, you do more things that are productive, that are hyper, and you know.
There is an interesting problem here. I'm just going to mention this. Maybe I'll pick it up again tomorrow. There's a verse. This verse needs about an hour to interpret all of it, but there's no man who is a tzaddik in the world who will do good and not sin. The verse in Ecclesiastes. No man who's a tzaddik in the world who will do good and not sin. So one piece that needs interpretation, the Sabra wrote that the Sabra brother said, what do you mean a tzaddik will do good? I mean, that's what a tzaddik is by definition. The one who does good. You know, I say that. There's no man, a tzaddik who'll do good will not, what's the doing good in therefore? So he said, there are different types of people in the world. There are people who are very conservative. You know, he doesn't do anything until he checks 7 times, and he doesn't do anything if there's any risk, and he makes sure that the things he does are, you know, just right. Then there are people who take risks, who have big projects, big plans. They're investing in doing something magnificent. But they're going to make mistakes. There's a certain element of mistake that comes merely with the fact of planning and trying to execute a great project. Now, that may be what the verse is talking about. There are 4 people, the Talmud mentions, who died only because of the sin of Adam, not because they did anything in their own lives to justify that they should die. Who are they? So the verse says, Binyamin, Jacob's youngest son, Amram, Moses' father, Yishai, David's father, and Kalev, one of David's sons. Now, wager, most of you haven't heard of most of them, right? These are not the top 10 or the top 20 famous Jews in history. How come these 4 made it and the really great Jews didn't make it? The answer is because the very great Jews had big projects. And because they had big projects, they failed them from time to time. They made mistakes from time to time. So it's not obvious that just being very cautious and conservative is the right path. It's more complicated than that.